they're all different, you know, so we kind of got to get them all to the same place. But like, as far as what I like to see is their level of trainability. You know, usually their mental state and stuff like that, how they come to work every day, because a lot of that will determine further on down the line how they progress, how they accept information, how they, you know, if they enjoy it. You know, I mean, that's a big part of it, is you can have one that can do everything, but if they don't enjoy it and they don't want to do it, you might get it done a little bit, but they're not going to be a consistent performer over a long period of time. These horses have got to like it.
You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to The Ride, a podcast brought to you by Horse and Rider Magazine, hosted by Nicole Cherico and Emily Carey. This episode of The Ride is brought to you by Tribute Equine Nutrition. Let's be honest, no two horses are the same, so it should be no surprise their nutrition needs are different. Tribute Equine Nutrition Specialists help you create personalized feeding plans based on your horse and how you ride, whether that's long miles on the trail, a full day of work, or weekends spent doing what you love. Their feeds are backed by a 100% money-back guarantee made in their own Ionophore-free facilities and are fixed formulas you can trust. So your horse gets consistent nutrition you can rely on, mile after mile, ride after ride. And if you're new to Tribute, your first bag is free, so you can try it with confidence. Take the stress out of feeding your horse and focus on what really matters, the ride. Visit TributeEquineNutrition.com to get started and let them know that Horse and Rider sent you. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Ride. This is your host, Nicole, and today I am sitting down with Peter DeFreitas. He is an NRHA professional based in Whitesboro, Texas, where he trains, raises, and competes in the reining division at the open level while also teaching and coaching riders in the non-pro division. Peter also just crossed the NRHA $1 million mark back in December. So thank you, Peter, for coming on and talking with us.
Oh, you bet. It was my pleasure for you guys to ask me.
Yeah. And for those who are part of our Horse and Rider On Demand platform and the Ride TV platform, he has also done a reining series with us in the past. So, you know, that's always been a fan favorite, and hoping that we can do some more with you in the future. But for those who might not subscribe to our platform or follow the reining horse industry, can you give a quick introduction about yourself and kind of talk about your background with horses and how you got involved with them?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been riding and showing reining horses since I was 10 years old. My grandfather had reining horses, and that's how I got involved with it. His NRHA number was actually 17, if that gives you any idea how long my family's been associated with reining horses. And that's how I got involved doing it, and that's what we had, was reining horses. And he had done some other stuff beforehand, trail and western riding, but I pretty much just did the reining horses. That was what he was interested in at that point. So, and I grew up in New Hampshire. That's where I got started with the horses and stuff like that. And
cool. Yeah, no, the East Coast, obviously Ohio is kind of the birthplace of reining. So that makes sense that, you know, the East Coast, you guys got involved. What was that like? Obviously, you were probably around some of the people who are kind of known as like the grandfathers of reining, since your family has been involved in it so for so long. Like, what was it like kind of growing up with them and that experience? And what is it like now seeing reining kind of progress and grow as a sport?
Yeah. Especially in the Northeast too. I mean, like Ohio, but even New York and Long Island, there was a lot of reining at the time when I was growing up that it was popular. Like, we had horse shows that were bigger. I mean, not necessarily by today's standards, but, you know, I remember getting to see guys that would come to Northampton, Massachusetts to show in the 2000 at it open. You know, I mean, a lot of guys had come there on their way to a world title, you know, and I got to see Bill Horn and Rocky Dare and Mike Flerta and Sam Smith and a lot of guys that were really involved then show and there. And, you know, it's pretty amazing to go from that where, like at the time when, if you had a 2000 added event in the opener and non-pro, I mean, that was a lot of money to be running at. I mean, guys would show their horses very hard to win those Boston trophies, you know, to now, you know, we can, there's people that have won $1 million in a year, you know, I mean, it's just, it's really unbelievable in that amount of time, how much our industry has grown and changed. And, you know, but getting to see those guys show at that early age definitely probably pushed me more to become a horse trainer, because they were, you know, so good at it. And there was a lot of fanfare at the time around them and their success and stuff like that.
So did you always know that you like wanted to be in the reining industry as a career or as a profession, or what were kind of the early turning points in your career that kind of shaped your path to becoming a professional?
Well, my grandfather always told me he didn't want me to be a horse trainer, but he pretty much set me up, from when I started riding, to go that direction, because he, took me around to a lot of different places. So I got to see a lot of different guys ride and stuff like that. And, you know, spent the summers at some different places. And, you know, I think looking back, he was just trying to improve my skills and stuff like that. But it really, you know, it made me kind of want to do that, because it's what I spent a lot of my time doing. And it was one of my main interests when I was younger, you know. You know, I had to ride every day if I wanted to go to the horse show. And so, like, I had to be at the barn all the time. And so it really just kind of immersed me in that lifestyle. And so, I mean, I knew pretty early on that's what I wanted to do, but I didn't know how I was going to get around my parents as far as being able to do it. So that took me a little while to figure out.
So obviously your grandfather has been a really big influence in how you got involved and everything. Were there any other kind of mentors or influences in your life that kind of helped guided you to where you are today?
Yeah, for sure. You know, like I spent the summers with Mike Flaherty, Bryant Pace, Jerry Cohen, a lot of different guys like that early, like when I was, you know, either not even able to drive yet or just got my license, that, you know, helped me along. Guys like Dutch Chapman, I mean, people that were at the horse shows, Sam Smith, same thing. I spent the summer with him. That's how I ended up going to work for him, you know. And, you know, just all those guys, you know, being around them and getting to see their operations. And, you know, I mean, for me, it was just, you know, getting to ride all these horses or getting to be around it in general was a big reason why that became my career, you know, because I just, it's what I wanted to do. And so just kind of took off with it in that direction.
So we talked about mentors. Were there any horses that kind of inspired you to keep going or kind of changed your career for the best in those early years?
Yeah, you know, my grandfather raised some horses, and so we showed horses that we raised. And there was two mares that I showed in the youth a lot, that really challenged me and made me become a better showman. And then, as I got further along, you know, my parents helped me buy a 3-year-old, and my first 3-year-old Sam Smith helped me with, and his name was Wave Cutter. And he was the first horse I ever won a, open trophy on. And even before that, backing up, I had the opportunity to get a 3-year-old from some people, the Hodges and the Sanborns, that lived in New Hampshire at the time. And that horse kind of probably made me want to get in the younger horses, because up until that point, I'd just been showing older horses. And so that horse kind of had some trouble changing leads and stuff. And so we had to work on that a lot, but, he was the first horse I ever made any kind of finals on or anything like that. I made the Carolina Classic. I don't know if I made the limited or the non-pro finals on him, but I know for sure that that horse was the first aged event horse that I ever got to show. And that really probably pushed me kind of to go that direction as far as the younger horses, because I just found it to be a lot of, you know, just so many different parts and teaching these things and them getting better. It was just, you know, very rewarding from that aspect.
Absolutely. Kind of going off of that, you've obviously built a program that's known for producing those fraternity horses and then, you know, going into the Derby and whatnot. You crossed the $1 million mark in 2025, I believe, after you made the finals, the level four finals in the fraternity, or was it before?
It was after. I needed like 12,000.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, the biggest fraternity, I think, when it comes to prize winning money in history, you crossed the $1 million mark. Let's talk a little bit about that milestone. Obviously, it's got to be pretty cool with your family being so involved in the reining as it has been to be able to cross that mark and you know, continue that journey.
Yeah, you know, it was definitely a long-term goal. Whenever I moved to Texas, for some reason, I decided, you know, I wanted to cross that mark before I turned 40, which was, I turned 40 in November, so it was right after it, but I'm going to count it because it was in the same year. but I had figured out, I can't remember exactly the number I had left. It was a fairly sizable number, and I had to win about $85,000 to $87,000 a year to reach it before I turned 40. But I, you know, decided to make that my long-term goal, per se, was to do that. And, yeah, you know, like from someone that grew up in the Northeast and started showing just local NRHA shows, you know, to be able to cumulatively be able to get there, you know, is a pretty big deal, you know. I mean, I remember when Bill Horn went over the $1 million mark, and it was just unheard of at that time. And, you know, now obviously there's quite a bit more $1 million riders, but I still think it's a pretty prestigious thing to be able to accomplish. And, you know, definitely makes it that you've stayed consistent for a long time, you know, and keep doing good and stuff like that, you know.
I mean, you got to be doing something right if you earn $1 million in the show pen, so. That's my thoughts on it. you know, you're doing something right if you can make $1 million in lifetime earnings. Obviously you've mentioned that you really like the young horses. I think when we did our video series with you, we did talk a lot about the 2-year-olds, the 3-year-olds. So let's kind of dive into that a little bit. So you obviously have quite a few young horses and prospects in your program. What are some of the non-negotiables that you're focusing on before you even like think about maneuvers and showing? And I feel like this is probably a good time to ask these questions because y'all are starting to ride your 2-year-olds and slowly kind of getting them into the programs.
Yeah, for sure. You know, they're all different, you know, so we kind of got to get them all to the same place, but like as far as what I like to see is their level of trainability, you know, usually their mental state and stuff like that, how they come to work every day. Because a lot of that will determine further on down the line how they progress, how they accept information, how they, you know, if they enjoy it, you know, I mean, that's a big part of it is you can have one that can do everything, but if they don't enjoy it and they don't want to do it, you might get it done a little bit, but they're not going to be a consistent performer over a long period of time. These horses have got to like it. And so a horse that wants to come to work and is nice minded can beat a lot of horses that are more talented than it just because they're trainable and they want to be there with you and they're willing to listen and kind of figure it out with you as you go along, you know. So stuff like that is probably more important to me than necessarily a lot of the other aspects of it.
Absolutely. And obviously their 2-year-old year in January is going to be a lot different than what we're looking at in their three-year-old year. But when it comes to kind of transitioning them into their three-year-old year, how are you kind of getting them ready for that fraternity, you know, mentality? Obviously, the fraternity, the NRHA fraternity is, it's pretty taxing on three-year-olds, right? You have to compete several times, you know, assuming that they don't have to change the schedule for EHV, but, you know, you're expecting them to go into the pen multiple times and in the span of 2 weeks and be flawless every round. How are you preparing them early in their year to kind of get them set up for success there?
So usually at the end of the two-year-old year, I look at it a little bit like a puzzle. You know, you got a lot of pieces that are just kind of laying there, and then you just start trying to put them together. And some of them, you know, some of them you get the outer edge first. Some of them you start with one corner. Some of them you start in the middle and kind of go out as far as to like make that puzzle come together for them. Again, I think it's really their mental capacity that really determines how good of a fraternity horse they can be. I think that if you have a horse that is good-minded and can be a solid plus half everywhere as a three-year-old, you can do a lot of good with one of those. Versus a horse that might be extremely talented but isn't as consistent. Because, like you said, you got to go show them three times. There's a lot of stuff that can go wrong. And I've found that the three-year-olds that I've had the most success on were ones that, like I said, kind of about the two-year-olds, they wanted to come to work every day and they wanted to be there and they were willing to take instruction. Because I think it's all about making a solid horse to be a successful fraternity horse. It isn't necessarily like about having one big maneuver. You kind of got to have something that's solid across the board. And that horse might not be the winner, but you can beat a lot of other horses that are maybe more talented just because they're more solid and they want to walk in there and show for you, you know? I mean, because that's kind of the next thing is you put all this stuff together or start putting it together and then you go show them and see what happens, you know? I mean, we've all been had situations where we think, oh, this one's going to be great. And it walks in there and it just either doesn't fire, doesn't, you know, it doesn't put the pieces together, or you have one that you're not sure about that you're like, well, it could be a nice horse, but they walk in there and all of a sudden they get better. And I've never really been able to understand why that is or put my finger on how to predict something like that. On horses that are just show horses, some of them are better when you turn the lights on, and I don't know why, but some of them are, and on the other turn, some of them are worse, you know. And even if they're not having to take a lot of pressure to get there, it's just not in that, just not in them to be good show horses sometimes, you know, or they just need to grow up, or you know. But I think statistically, the horses that are consistent always make the best three-year-olds. Now, as a derby age horse, it gets a little bit different because those horses are bigger and stronger and have had more time to mature. So sometimes your good fraternity horse doesn't mean it's going to be a good derby horse. You know, maybe it was a 220 horse as a three-year-old and that's it, you know. But as they get older, you got to be able to mark more and make those finals and stuff like that. So that horse that I don't know if plateau is the word to use, because a 220 horse is a pretty dang nice horse. But that's what they are, and they don't keep progressing, they might not make a level 4 derby horse. But they could have been a really good three-year-old because they were willing to go in there and be solid everywhere.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, like, to that point, you know, a great three-year-old in the open division, if they don't make it as a open division derby horse, there's still a career for them. There's still a place for them, whether that be in the lower levels or the non-pro or what it might be. So it's cool to see these horses continue their career, but maybe they don't stay in that level 4. Maybe they move to another division.
Yeah, and, you know, that's part of how the fraternity got started, too, was they were looking for a way to get guys to train horses for this event that would eventually go on and be non-pro horses. And that's how they did it, was by starting the fraternity. And they figured, well, we'll have it at the end of the year. You know, these guys will get these things trained up, go show them a few times, and then, you know, owners and whoever, non-pros, they're going to have horses to show. Because without that build up to the fraternity and having a reason to train those horses for reining, and I'm talking about when the NRHA first got started, you know, there wasn't a bunch of weekend horse shows or whatever. That was it, you know, and that's what caused these horses to start being trained for this event and to get ready was the fraternity, so that people would have horses to show later on. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely true, like, that, you know, those horses all end up kind of where they're supposed to be, but that is part of the reason why the fraternity got started, was to get those horses trained up for someone else.
Oh, I don't think I actually really knew that was like the core reason as to why they started the fraternity, but I love it because the non-pros, I mean, as you know, you're a professional, you work with owners and non-pros and all that, you know, they keep this business alive and they're buying and selling and breeding and keeping horses in training. I know my trainer he's always going to have a job with me because I'm always needing help. but poor Devin Warren. anyway, with that said, you're seeing a lot more four-year-old events, which is really cool for those three-year-olds who might not be mature enough, or they might just be, you know, slow to grow physically. And so that's kind of a cool division that you're starting to see more payouts for as well.
Yeah. And I really think that that's a great thing for our industry as a whole, because now you can tell somebody, hey, this either, you know, this horse just needs more time, you know, or we just kind of need to bag this, it gets hurt, whatever. You still have, as a four-year-old, where, you know, you don't have to compete against those 5, 6, and 7-year-olds. I mean, obviously some 4-year-olds can for sure compete against those horses, but I think it gives a great avenue to some of these horses that either are a little bit in between, or they need a little bit more time to mature, or, you know, we've all thought that, man, if I had another 6 months before I really had to have this horse ready, I think it could be that much better. And now with that, with the money they're putting into the 4-year-old events, and, you know, now the NRBC has one, the Derby has one, the 100X obviously has theirs, and the High Roller kind of started off with their 4-year-old deal. I really think it's great for those horses, because there's so many of them either that, you know, weren't just ready as 3-year-olds, you know, or maybe they got hurt, or for whatever reason. It gives you a whole nother year of, if you just want to show them in 4-year-old events, you can now. And where that was, you know, set just not even that long ago, 5, 6 years ago, that wasn't the case. You know, I mean, you showed them, and I think there's always been places to show those horses, but I think it gives them an avenue to win a substantial amount of money now as 4-year-olds that either weren't ready for whatever reason, or maybe they were ready, or maybe they're just, that's kind of where they're at, is they need to be competing against other 4-year-olds and can't compete against those older horses.
Yeah, I love that they're adding these divisions. I love that, what was it, in the last 10 years now, we're seeing the Derby events now having 7-year-olds. Some even have 8-year-olds. Like, I love that we're giving these horses more opportunities to compete, instead of just, you have your 3-year-old fraternity stuff and you have your Derby stuff and then you're done.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that is how it used to be. There was the fraternity and there was not much else after that. I mean, you know, whenever I started showing horses, that's how it was. I mean, the Derby was for 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds in some spots. And there weren't these regional Derbies then either that there are now that you can show in. I mean, you know, talking about where I grew up, I mean, they had a fraternity there that was not sizable by today's standards, but it was a sizable amount then. But there was no derby. You know, everybody showed in the ancillary divisions. That's where you showed, you know, the majority of the horses, you know. You had the Carolina Classic Derby on the East Coast, and that was kind of it at that time, you know. And a lot, I remember going as a kid, and a lot of those guys from Texas, Tim McQuay and Tom McCutcheon, you'd see all those guys in Carolina for that Derby because it was one of the biggest events in the country, you know, besides the Derby. And, you know, there just wasn't. Now you can go to almost any horse show and show an aged event of some level every weekend, just about. You know, and that part of our industry has really changed a lot.
Absolutely. It's, and I feel like even just within the last 10 years, it's changed so much with the addition of events like the Run for a Million and, you know, all of that kind of big money stuff that's backing some of these classes now.
Yeah, definitely. The Run for a Million's changed things a lot as far as the amount of money being paid out. You know, once the Run for a Million came along, they upped the fraternity purse. They upped it again this past year, you know. I mean, I've been saying for a long time that if you make the level four finals, you should be able to walk out of there with $25,000. And now you can. I mean, those are supposed to be the 30 best three-year-olds in the country. And anybody that's done it knows how easy you can go from having a good run to being in the bottom 10 because you broke gate or something happened or whatever, you know. And for those people, those owners, to keep wanting to go, you know, that gives them, you know, more of a reason to keep sending these horses is, you know, and I mean, it just makes sense to me that those horses at the bottom get paid good too, you know, because they had to make the finals too. You know, I mean, they had to put two hard runs on their horses to even get there. You know, I mean, and even maybe some of them just had bad luck in the finals, you know, I mean, they still need to get paid. And like you said, the 100X has put in more money in the four-year-old events. And just in general, overall, I think I see our purses going up and up and paying more, which is good for everyone, you know.
Absolutely. It encourages people to be breeding. It encourages them to be going to all of these shows. And there's so many to pick from. You don't have to go to every single one. You can pick and choose what fits your horse.
Yeah, 100%, you know, and that's something that, you know, they're not all going to be big aged event horses. You know, some of them aren't going to play at that level, and that's okay, because there is, even besides the regional, you know, you have the ancillary classes, the novice horse, the regular open classes. I mean, there's right now, there's so many opportunities for horses to be shown and go show at different levels that they're capable at. I do think sometimes people get laser focused on the big events and their horse not competing or not being good enough to compete there. But there's so many places available for these horses to show that I feel like if you've got a horse that is capable of doing this, you can find somewhere that they can be competitive at.
Absolutely. So kind of talking about this fraternity horse to derby horse transition, obviously your fraternity horses are now heading into their derby years. It's January. You finished off at a really great ending point, their three-year-old year. How are you transitioning those horses kind of into that derby mindset? Is there much of a transition? What's kind of going on in January, the first couple months of their four-year-old derby careers?
So kind of, it kind of depends on, if they went to the fraternity, if they, you know, maybe they didn't go to the fraternity. If they go to the fraternity, I try to give them off like the whole month of December and kind of into January. And then I would just have them start trotting, you know, and then just start kind of going back to it slow and seeing where I'm at for this year. Because like I said, a lot of stuff changes. You know, they may need more time to get back to that level that you need them to be at. The 1 4-year-old that I showed at, or he's now 4, that I showed at the fraternity, I'm thinking about taking him to the NRBC because they have that 4-year-old division. But I'm going to kind of get back to him and kind of let him tell me what he's ready for, because I don't know that. I've had several four-year-olds that I skipped the NRBC on just because I didn't think they were quite ready to be at that level again yet. And so I don't think it's a bad thing to skip it. But now that they have that four-year-old event, I'm thinking more seriously about starting to see if he's going to be ready for that. And, you know, I try to just go back to him and, you know, kind of see where we are and keep in mind some of the things either that I thought needed to be better last year or maybe weren't quite as solid as I wanted them to be, you know, starting small with stuff like that. That's usually what I start working on, is whatever I didn't like, you know, like if something about changing lanes or starting the turn or, you know, it's usually little things. It's usually not big things at that point, you know, but that's usually how I kind of get back to going again on them, is just, you know, I try to let them have some time to themselves and get rode again without a whole lot of pressure. They just get to ride around a little bit and then just start easing stuff into their routine again.
Well, yeah, and it brings up a good point that, like, you know, at the end of the day, they're still horses. They need time to rest. I know I would be stir crazy and burnt out if I had to go to work every day and put out 100% every day. And so you're, you know, setting them up for success with longevity, especially in the reining, where the patterns, while they change, they're still fairly similar, right? You're still changing leads in the middle of the arena. You're probably spinning in the middle of the arena. You know, you have your circles, your fast, slow. How are you keeping them mentally engaged and not anticipating or burning out or anything like that? Because, yeah, they figure it out. They're smart.
Yeah, for sure. I think in the last several years, that's changed some for me, because there was always like that stigma for a long time. You don't want to change leads in the middle. You don't want to do this in the middle. You don't want to, like, you know, you do it there when you show. But I think that type of mindset kind of created some of those problems that we have. You know, I think it's just like anything else. You have to teach them how you want them to approach it there. You know, that a lot of times if you run into trouble there, you kind of need to work through it there and have different ways of working around it, either, you know, how to handle their anxiety or they're leaning or they're doing this or they're doing that, versus trying to kind of not do it at all there and then just kind of surprising them with it when you show them. And I think a lot of these horses, I think that's part of the reason why our horses are lasting longer, is I think a lot of guys are doing things differently like that. So that horse isn't like, oh, here we go in the middle, something's going to happen. They're just like, oh, here we go. You know, like, this is not a big deal. This is part of what we do, you know, and they learn to, like, figure out how to get through there. And I think you can take some of that anxiety away from them because you can work through it at home versus just doing it in the show pen or going and schooling them and working on it and different things like that, so that you train those horses to be show horses instead of training them to do something over here and then kind of like, okay, yeah, now let's do it right here. And I know we haven't done this before and, you know, like, or we don't do it that much, but when it happens, I want it to be good. And, you know, I think that the training of that part of our show horses has changed a lot. Like I said, probably the last 10 to 15 years, you know, of doing different things and teaching these horses how to be show horses instead of kind of like shying away from that problem. We're helping that horse understand what they're supposed to be doing instead of just kind of like trying to get through it, you know? And I also think that a lot of times those horses that get bad habits are ones either that were shown too soon, or maybe they weren't ready. Maybe they weren't mentally ready. And you had to kind of get through something. And that is really what causes that horse to have an issue there in the long term, is if they weren't really prepared to do something where you asked them to do it.
Yeah, that makes total sense. It's always really interesting to me. And whenever I'd go on location to work with some of these trainers and we'd be talking about pattern placement and just practicing it at home, there were some people who were like, yeah, we do the patterns all the time at home. And then there were others that were like, no, we never do the pattern. So it's really interesting to hear that the mindset has shifted a little bit more towards like, yeah, we should be working on these maneuvers where they happen in the arena.
Yeah. And I think that's all, you know, I mean, I think you have to set it up. I think you can break it down and put it, for me personally, I can do something. Maybe it's not in the middle. Maybe it's over here, but I set it up the same. Or I set it up over here and then I go back over here and I work it till, you know, that horse is quiet about it, or, you know, going around the ends or speeding them up, slowing them down, you know, setting them up so that they think, oh, I'm supposed to speed up here. And then you just take it away from them and kind of go somewhere else with it. You know, I think you have to be pretty creative about it to keep it fresh. You know, like you'd asked me about keeping it fresh for horses and keeping them interested is part of them not, you know, everything about a horse is anticipatory. And everything about a reining horse, you don't want them to anticipate. And then we teach them something for X amount of time, trying to get them to think about it. And then we pretty much spend the whole rest of the time getting them not to think about it. So I think in different ways, you have to set up your training program so that that horse understands what you want, but he doesn't get excited about it or doesn't get ahead of you when you're doing it. And on some of them, the only way to do that is to do it until they go, okay, and take a big deep breath. And then, you know, it's not a big deal anymore, you know? But I do think there's different ways you can kind of set things up in different aspects, changing leads out of a circle in a straight line and, you know, like different drills and things like that. So that, because a lot of these horses now are so good that if they're set up right, they're all probably going to do it. So it's not necessarily like you may not have to practice the maneuver all the time, but you can set it up in different ways and keep that horse so it's thinking about you. And it's not just like, oh, well, when we get to here, this is what happens.
Absolutely. So yeah, great advice. Kind of shifting over to maybe like more of like a non-pro rider or someone who's interested in owning a fraternity or a young horse, what's kind of your advice to them? Because obviously this is a very long road, especially when you're dealing with people who buy two-year-olds. And there's a lot that can happen between their two-year-old year and the end of their three-year-old year. And maybe they make it, maybe they don't, maybe they get hurt, maybe whatever it might be. What's kind of your advice for someone who wants to get involved in that kind of younger event category?
You know, I think it's true of anything in our business. You need to find somebody that you trust, that either your goals that align with theirs or what they have accomplished have aligned with you. You know, I think there's a lot of different ways that you know, you can go about it. But I think the big thing is you have to be able to trust the process. And so either if you're sending somebody a horse as a two-year-old, or you're looking to buy a three-year-old or something like that, you need to do your research, find somebody that you feel like is going to represent you well as far as how you want your horse treated, how you want your horse ridden, and also that how successful do you want to be? Like, do you want to have your horse make a level four open finals at the fraternity? Do you want to, you know, have your horse get a check at a fraternity somewhere? You know, I mean, there's a lot of different levels of success to people. And I don't think that you can, you're not going to get there if you don't do your own research about what it takes. As far as what kind of horse do you need? What kind of person do you want to send a horse to, you know, type of thing. And I mean, there's so many different guys that do a good job now that, you know, and they all get there a different way sometimes too. You know, me personally, almost always the horses that I end up showing are ones that we started. There are some guys that go out and buy them, you know, I mean, just different ways of having success just like that. You know, I think that's a different, and you also have to be honest with yourself about what level of horse you have. And if somebody's telling you, you know, this horse is X and you think it's Y, you know, you need to trust in their opinion enough to know that they're trying to do the best thing for you, you know? Because if that's not the case, then you probably shouldn't be paying them every month. If you don't trust their opinion, you know, then you should probably go find somebody else. You know, if you don't think that they're going to do you a good enough job to tell you the truth, then that's, you know, or if you're not willing to accept the truth, that's a whole nother conversation.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, for those, obviously, for those that want to learn more about you, they can see your video series on Ride TV, Horse and Rider on Demand. Hopefully we can get something else in the books and kind of continue from that video series we did a couple of years ago. But if someone's wanting to kind of follow you along on social media or just like learn more about you or see what you guys are up to, do you guys have any social channels or websites or anything?
Yeah, we're on Facebook and Instagram under DeFreitas Performance Horses.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. I was glad I get to do it.
Once again, we'd like to thank Tribute Equine Nutrition for sponsoring this episode of The Ride. Thank you guys for tuning into The Ride podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and please be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow Horse and Rider Magazine on social media and find us at horseandrider.com to see all the cool things that we're up to. And if you have any comments or questions, please be sure to hit us up at horseandrider@equinenetwork.com. We want to hear from you guys. And if you like what you're listening to, please be sure to leave us a review on iTunes.